Benjamin Rush was one of the founding fathers of the United States. In fact, he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Benjamin Rush was also a physician. He was one of our first psychiatrists. He gave himself to what he called the curing of the diseases of the mind. Perhaps because Benjamin Rush was a psychiatrist, dreams played an important part in his career. In fact, one dream that he had in 1785 changed his life completely. Benjamin Rush dreamt that he was standing beneath Christ Church in the city of Philadelphia. A huge crowd had gathered, and a man climbed to the roof of the church, up into its steeple, and then onto its weather vane, and wrapped his legs around its balls. When Benjamin Rush asked somebody what the man was doing, he was told that that man thought he could control the weather. In his hands, the weather vane was not simply an indicator of the wind. It was a director of the wind. But somehow, on that day, the venture was not coming off very well. The man called for the rain to fall, and the sun began to shine. He called for the winds to blow, and the streets of Philadelphia were calm. At first, the man became agitated, and then he fell into a deep depression. And Benjamin Rush said, "The man is mad." And then from the steeple of the church, a messenger appeared dressed as Mercury. And he came flying to the earth carrying a huge placard. And on that sign inscribed in Latin were the words, "About you, a story is being told." It takes a great degree of genius for a man to interpret his dream within his dream. And when Benjamin Rush awoke, he recognized that that man on the steeple of the church was none other than himself. That he had been attempting to influence the winds of history. And he recognized that those winds were beyond his control. As a result of that dream, Benjamin Rush left political life and never returned to it again. That dream was magnificent in its scope, in its brilliance, in its drama. It could have been the dream of a physician who gives himself to the curing of disease and comes to recognize that often the difference between life and death lies in forces he does not control. It was indeed the dream of a politician who wanted to influence the current of history and recognize that there were things moving in history that he could not touch. For in Washington, when all is said and done, infinitely more is said than is done. It could have been the dream of a Christian or a Christian leader, of somebody who desperately wants to influence his time for God and discovers that there are forces at work in a secular society that he cannot touch or control. There are times when that has been my dream. There have been times in my life when, having given myself to touching the world for God, I have come to realize that the battle seems overwhelming. Every day we live, more people are born than we have been able to reach, so that every day we live, we get further from accomplishing our task. And there are times when I want to settle for some cheap doctrine of election and decide that if God wants to win the world, he can do it himself. That I'll retire to some seminary classroom and talk about things that don't really matter. But when that melancholy of a soul comes on me, I have taken some inspiration from the life of the Apostle Paul. To be honest, Paul was not always a model for me. As a young man, I felt that Paul was a man apart. He had a power I did not possess, an authority I did not know. When you stand next to someone who is 20 feet tall, you're not even inspired to stand up straight. But a few years ago, a friend of mine and I were able to go to the Near East, and we traced again, in part at least, the travels of that great apostle. And during that trip, Paul became a man for me. He was a man who was 5'7", whose eyesight was dim, whose health was poor. It was George Truett who said that once he saw the tracks of a wounded rabbit red across the snow. And those were the tracks of the Apostle Paul across the Roman Empire. if we face obstacles today in winning a world for Jesus Christ, he did yet more. Demon-infested, disease-ridden was the world in which Paul lived. And yet that little Jew with a band of nobodies not only left his thumbprint upon the ancient world, but he actually changed the course of history. Today, we name our dogs after Nero and our sons after Paul. The question that plagued me for months was, what made the difference? What enabled a man like Paul to not only touch his day, but touch the whole current of history? You might respond, Paul was able to do that because the wind of God was at his back. He had a power that was beyond anything we know. But if the New Testament tells us anything, it tells us that that is not true. That you and I, too, are indwelt by God's Spirit. I came to the conclusion that the difference was not in Paul in the Holy Spirit, but in Paul's human spirit. There was something in the man himself, something in his zeal, something in his determination that enabled Paul to make a difference in his world. That human spirit of the Apostle Paul breaks through the pages of the New Testament. And no place is it clearer than in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. In 1 Corinthians 9, verses 24 to 27, Paul says this, "Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get that prize. Everyone who competes in the game goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body. I make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize." Paul wrote those words in a sports-oriented society. It was, in that sense, a society very much like our own. Here in the United States, if you visit a college campus, you often discover that the most impressive buildings are not the libraries or the laboratories or the lecture halls. They are often the stadia. And in those stadiums, Saturday after Saturday, 70,000 people who desperately need exercise sit in the sleet and rain to watch 22 men who don't need the exercise playing in the fields below. But if we are oriented to sports, the Greek world was yet more. We date all time forward and backward from the birth of Jesus Christ. The Jews dated time from what they thought was the creation of the world in 3761 B.C. The Romans dated time from the mythical founding of Rome by Romulus and Remus in 753 B.C. But the Greeks dated time from the beginning of the Olympic Games. What the sacrifices were to the Jewish system, what the victory parades were to the Romans, the games were to the Greeks. Every 4 years, the Olympic Games took place in Elis in Olympia. Every 3 years, the Isthmian Games took place in the city of Corinth. They were called the Isthmian Games because Corinth sits on an isthmus between the Peloponnesian Peninsula and the mainland of Greece. And to that isthmus, people crowded to see the contest. The noblest, finest men in Greece were selected to be judges. They were dressed in purple robes. They sat on high thrones. They began the contest. They awarded the prizes, and they saw to it that the athletes competed according to the rules. For 9 months before those Olympic Games, those Isthmian Games took place, athletes prepared in the gymnasia throughout the country. The word gymnasium means or at least comes from the Greek word gymnos, which means naked. The Greeks were not squeamish about the human body, and so when the athletes prepared, when the athletes competed, they competed in the nude. the Jews, the Hellenistic Jews who inhabited the Greek cities, could not believe that the athletes who competed without clothes on were not involved in some kind of sexual orgy, so they would have absolutely nothing to do with the games. But Paul would not be so put off. He admired those athletes. He admired them for their skill. He admired them for their training. But above all, he admired them for their determination. For when those men prepared, when those men competed, they competed to win. They were not like fat businessmen trying to sweat off some extra pounds in a spa. They were not like joggers puffing around the high school track for exercise. When those men prepared, when those men competed, they did so in order to get a prize. Everything they had was given to the winning of the crown. And the crown they received was a twisted garden leaf that was placed upon their brow. But with that crown there went fame and glory. Poets composed poems in their honors. Singers sang songs in their praise. And Paul says that is the spirit that he brought to his ministry. It was the spirit of the Olympic athlete who is determined that above all else he or she will win the gold. It is the spirit that sacrifices everything necessary, gives up every desirable pleasure, so that somehow in competing in the contest, they will win the prize. Paul says that's what he did, that he kept his body under, that he denied himself the ordinary pleasures of life, so that like the athlete in the Olympic Games, he might not only run, but that he would run to win. That's the spirit of the apostle. That's the spirit that he brought to his ministry. That's the spirit that made the difference. But the question is, if this is the spirit that Paul brought to his ministry, what was the goal of his ministry? What was it towards which Paul ran, for which Paul fought? And the answer to that is found in verse 16 of chapter 9, where Paul says, "Woe is me if I preach not the gospel." That is the goal of Paul's ministry, to which he brought the spirit of an Olympic athlete, was the goal of making Christ known, of preaching the gospel. It is a thing strange, I believe, when Paul says, "Woe is me if I preach not the gospel." You might have thought that Paul would have said, "Woe is the world if I do not preach the gospel." For if men and women are lost and separated from God, and they must hear of Jesus Christ, and they do not hear of him, they will be lost forever. It would be easy to understand why he would say, "Woe is the world." But Paul says, "Woe is me." You see, to the apostle, the preaching of the gospel was both a compulsion and an obligation. It was a compulsion because he was an apostle, and God had tapped him on the shoulder and separated him out and called him to preach the good news about Jesus Christ to the Gentile world. But it was not only a compulsion, it was an obligation. Because bound up in the nature of the gospel is the duty to share it with others. If a scientist discovered the cure for some dreadful disease, then that scientist is obligated to share that cure with the world. If a scientist were to discover the cure for cancer and she withheld that cure and kept it to herself, that would be a sin against science. That would be a breach of ethics, and no scientist would do that unless they were spiritually and emotionally dead. But for us to know the good news of the gospel, if you know the relief of having your sins forgiven, if you know the delight of having a personal relationship with God, if you know what it is to have light break into your darkness, if you have that message, you become indebted to share that message with others. And so Paul says there is an obligation laid upon him to proclaim that message, and woe to me if I do not proclaim it. In fact, if you look at verse 16, Paul says that when he receives a reward in his ministry, It will not be for preaching the gospel. That is a duty, an obligation that is laid upon him. He says in verse 16, "Woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward, but if not voluntarily, I am simply discharging a trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge and not make use of my rights in preaching it." Paul is saying that the preaching of the gospel gains us no reward. It's an obligation that we owe to God, that we owe to other men and women. But that he would receive a reward if he preached the gospel voluntarily. He would receive a reward if he gave up his rights in order that other people might know the good news about Jesus Christ. Just as an Olympic athlete denies himself pleasures in training, just as the Olympic swimmer turns her back upon certain rites that are hers in order that she might be better prepared for the game, Paul says that he will receive the prize when he is willing to give up rights in order that Christ may be known. The question then is, what rights did Paul surrender for the sake of the gospel? As you look through 1 Corinthians 9, you discover that Paul tells us of many rights he was willing to surrender. For example, in verse 4, he says, "Or don't we have the right to food and drink?" In the context, Paul has been speaking about people who were upset about eating meat that had been offered on an idol's altar. Paul knew that when you put a sacrifice on an altar, that sacrifice did not change the nature of the meat. But there were many people who could not handle that. Their consciences were weak. And so Paul says that he would be willing never to eat meat again if somehow that interfered with the proclaiming of the message. Paul would never touch an alcoholic beverage again if somehow that stood in the way of people coming to know Jesus Christ. Not only did he give up the right to food and drink if it were necessary, but in verse 5 he says, "Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brother and Cephas? Or is it only I and Barnabas who must work for a living?" Paul says that a second right that he gave up was the right to be married. I must confess that I do not identify with Paul at this point. I could not imagine what life would have been for me had it not been for the love and companionship of Barnabas. There have been times when I have been discouraged, and with her joyous, buoyant spirit, she has lifted me up. And other times when I have been infected with an unseemly pride, and with her comments has pricked it and brought me back to life again. I cannot imagine ministry without her. And yet Paul was willing to forego the delights and pleasures of marriage, since for him that encumbered him in the ministry God had placed in his hands. The third right that Paul says he gave up was the right to receive a salary. And in verses 7 through verse 14, Paul piles argument upon argument to show that he had a right to receive a salary from this Corinthian church, many of whom in the church he had won to Christ. He says, for example, in verse 7, "Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat its grapes? Who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk?" Just common sense says that a minister has a right to live from the ministry. A soldier, when he goes to battle, is not asked to raise his own support. A grape grower is always able to have grapes on his table. A dairyman always has enough milk to drink. Common sense says that Paul, having established the church, brought these people to Christ, had a right to receive a wage from them. But not only did common sense argue his right to receive a wage, but the law too said that he had that right. He says in verse 8, "Do I say all of this merely from a human point of view, common sense? Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it's written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Back in Deuteronomy 25, the law said that you are not to put a muzzle on the ox as he treads the grain. You are to allow him to eat all of the grain that he can. God did not simply say that for animals. It's an argument for the lesser to the greater. If it's true for an ox, it's true for a man. So that those who minister the gospel have a right to live from the gospel. And again in verse 13, Paul argues the case from the temple. He says, don't you know that those who work in the temple get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share what is offered at the altar? Whether you are a Jew, whether you are a pagan, you knew that when an offerer brought a sacrifice and laid it on the altar, only a part of that sacrifice was burned. Another part of the sacrifice was given back to the worshiper, and a third part of the sacrifice was given to the priest as a kind of honorarium. The Jews, the pagans, understood that the priest who worked at the altar had a right to partake of the altar. And Paul, having worked in the ministry, had a right to be paid in the ministry. And if that were not enough, if common sense and the law and the practice of the temple did not argue it, the Lord himself has said that. What he says in verse 14, in the same way the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. The laborer is worthy of his hire. That did not come from the AFL-CIO. That came from the lips of Jesus Christ. And Paul is saying that he had a right to receive a wage. He had a right to receive payment from the Corinthians. But because of his desire that the gospel be preached unhindered, Paul says he did not take that right. Notice in verse 12, he says, if others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? But we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. And again in verse 15, but I have not used any of these rights. And I'm not writing this in order that you would do such things for me. What Paul is saying is that in his desire to preach the gospel, to make it known to the world, that when he came to the city of Corinth, although he had a right to receive a wage from the Corinthian church, he did not take that wage. He wanted them to know that unlike the hucksters that often occupied their city and spoke to them in order to receive their money, Paul did not come to Corinth to get Corinthian gold. He came to Corinth to get Corinthians. And so he gave himself to the ministry and supported himself in the ministry. Can you imagine what that must have meant? During the day, out in the marketplace, arguing with the pagan philosophers and making Christ known, on the Sabbath, preaching in the synagogue and speaking to the religious leaders of his time. And then when the day was over, tired and weary, coming back to work on the making of tents with which to support himself. But that, you see, is the spirit of the Olympic athlete. Paul is saying, I am so determined that men and women will know God that I will make any sacrifice necessary in order that I might achieve my goal, that I might make Christ known. You see, what Paul knew was this, that only fanatics make a difference in the world. The folks who are casual about their faith, the folks who are casual about a cause, never really live on the cutting edge of things. Paul knew that, humanly speaking, the success or failure of any cause depends on the risk, depends on the sacrifice, depends on the pain that people are willing to expend to see that that cause succeeds. And Paul was a fanatic for the gospel, as an Olympic athlete is a fanatic in order to gain the gold. And he would give up any right in order to achieve his goal. But there's a problem with fanatics. The trouble is that they can become so zealous for the cause that in their effort to win people to Christ, they drive them away, that they build walls instead of bridges. And so Paul goes on to say in this chapter that not only did he give up every right in order that men and women might hear the gospel and be evangelized. But Paul says that he made himself a slave to every man's thinking. He bound himself to every man's conscience in order to make Christ known. That's what he says in verse 19. Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Paul never changed his message. He always proclaimed Jesus Christ and him crucified, his person and his work. But Paul knew that all of us are touched by our background. All of us are shaped by our culture. All of us are affected by our religious training. And so while Paul never changed the message, the gospel he preached in Jerusalem, he preached in Antioch, the gospel he preached in Corinth, he preached in Rome, Paul knew that in order to make the gospel clear so that people could understand it in an unthreatened sort of way, that often he had to adapt himself to people's thinking. He had to bend himself to people's conscience so he could get rid of the trivia to get to the essentials. So he says to the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. The Jewish nation was encumbered with all kinds of laws. To the Romans, it was a sticky religion. And Paul was free from all of that ceremony, all of those things that seemed to be like a weight on the Jewish people. But when Paul went into a Jewish community, he picked up the food laws. He practiced what they practiced. He gave himself to their ceremonies. If in doing that, he could make the gospel clear. Or he says, to those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law. So as to win those not under the law. You cannot imagine what the law was in the first century. To all of the laws and the regulations of the Old Testament, the Jewish leaders had added laws upon laws upon laws until the people carried a burden difficult to bear. And Paul knew that he was free from the law. That was a basic tenet of his gospel. But Paul also knew the issue. The issue was not to get people to stop keeping the law. The issue was to get them to stop keeping the law, believing that that gave them a right relationship to God. And if keeping the law and all of its regulations and all of its food stipulations could help him better make that point, then Paul, who was completely free from the law, anything but a legalist, put himself back under it in order to make the gospel clear. Or, Paul says, to those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but under the law of Christ, so as to win those not having the law. Paul says, when I moved among the Greeks, I did not bring all of that baggage of Judaism with me. To the Hellenists, I became the Hellenistic man. When Paul preached to the Jews in the book of Acts, he loaded his sermons with quotations from the Old Testament. But when he preached to the Athenians, he began with the pagan altars and enforced his sermons by quotations from the pagan poets. When he was dealing with the Greeks, he became a Greek. It was as though he had never heard of the law. So he could not let that stand by itself. He says, but I am under law to Christ. That is, there is a righteousness that I have that I can never surrender. And finally, in verse 22, to the weak, I've become as weak in order to win the weak. In the context, he's talking about people of a weak conscience. There are folks to whom Paul ministered who had all kinds of unbelievable hang-ups. They had more questions about the trivia of life than you could ever imagine. And these weak folks often saw those trivial things as the important things, those little things as the big things. And Paul says, in that case, I did not offend those people. I did not insist on my right to be free from all of those regulations. When I was with people who were weak, I became like one who was weak. That is, I became a slave to every man's conscience. I became a slave to every man's way of thinking. If in doing that, I could make the gospel of Jesus Christ clear. And then Paul concludes that paragraph with what I believe is the great statement of strategy for evangelism. Paul says, I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. What Paul is saying is, I will do anything. I will give up any right. I will bend myself to any man's way of thinking. I will do anything short of sinning in order to win men and women to God. That's the spirit of the athlete. That's the spirit of a winner. That's the spirit of the Olympic champion. That's the spirit of the apostle. That's the spirit that will make a difference in the world. I will do anything short of sinning if by doing that I can win men and women to God. And you can see the passion of the apostle as it explodes in the verbs he uses. For example, in verse 19 he says, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. You know that there was then as now somebody who would put his hand up and say, wait a minute, Paul, you know you don't win them. The Spirit of God is the one who wins them. Paul says, away with that. I bring to my task the spirits of a champion, and I go after men and women as though it all depended upon me. Or later on in that chapter he says, I have become all things to all men, so that by all means I might save some. Somebody says, wait a minute, Paul. You know you don't save them. It's God who saves them. And Paul says, away with that. I am a worker with God, and I have given myself to the task of evangelism, and I give up any right. I make myself a slave to any man's conscience if in doing that I can win men to Christ, and I act and live as though it depended upon me to save them from the burning. That's the spirit of the apostle. And that's the spirit of a church that is really bleeding blood red in its community. That's the spirit of men and women who make a difference in their society and make a difference in their world. It has always been so. It was the spirit of William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, who went into the inner city of London and reached out for people that nobody else cared for and lifted those denizens of society to God. And when he was asked at the end of his life the secret of his ministry, William Booth replied, God has had all of me. It was the secret of John Wesley, who touched England for God, and in the verdict of the historian Woodrow Wilson, saved Britain from a French revolution. And in his diary, he recorded an incident. He said, I was on my way to Nottingham and was held up by a highwayman, and I witnessed to him. It was the spirit of John Knox, who would put himself before God and pray again and again, oh God, give me Scotland lest I die. The spirit of the apostle, the spirit of an evangelist. It's the spirit of men and women who take God seriously and know that they have been sent on a mission to take the gospel to their society and the world. If you're a sports buff, you have heard the ABC, Wide World of Sports. At the beginning of it, Jim McKay talks about the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. Paul knew that. In fact, in verse 27, he says, I keep my body under. I keep it in submission. I give up my rights in order that having preached about all of this to others, I myself might be disqualified for the prize. Paul knew that it's possible for people to spend their lives and not invest them. It's possible for people to go through the motions of living but never understand why they are involved in life. He knew that there are people who throughout all eternity will be losers, disqualified for the prize, because they didn't even know there was a race going on. They didn't even know there was a boxing match in which they were to participate. Disqualified because they sat in the grandstands and didn't become part of the game. On the other hand, there was for Paul the thrill of victory, the thrill of receiving from the hand of Jesus Christ not simply a gold medal, not simply a twisted garland leaf, but a golden crown that signified the approval of God. And for that eternal approval of God, he gave himself to evangelism and gave up every right and sacrificed himself to every man's way of thinking, that people might know God. Paul Richards, the Olympic athlete who appears on the front of Wheaty boxes, has a question that he likes to ask men and women who have won a gold medal in the Olympics. He says that he's asked it scores of times, and his question is simply this: what do you do with the pain? Those who have heard him tell me that Richard says that never once has he asked that question of a winner who has said to him, "What do you mean?" They simply tell him how they handled the pain. There is no prize without the pain. There is no glory without the discipline. There is no winning unless you're willing to sacrifice to win. There is the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. Imagine what it would be throughout eternity to discover that you were in the race and you were running in the wrong direction, that you were in the ring and you did not even know who the opponent was. Imagine through all eternity to realize that you could live this brief span of time and you threw your influence away and never once had anything to do individually or corporately with really winning people to Jesus Christ. Imagine the agony of defeat, to be disqualified from the crowd. Or imagine instead the thrill of victory, to stand at the winner's stand and to receive from the nail-pierced hand of Jesus Christ the golden crown, and to hear from him who is your Lord and Master and King and Sovereign his eternal verdict on your life: "Well done. Well done. Well done. You have been a winner."